Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. Hi, everyone. This is Vic. Just to let you know that there is a mention of suicide in this episode. Coming up on Bookshelfie.
I don't think thinking about death is morbid. I don't think there's anything more life-affirming than remembering that you're going to die. Because the minute you have that thought, or you think about someone who isn't here anymore, you're back in the moment of living. You're grateful for the moment of living. I allowed myself to be imperfect. I allowed myself to make mistakes and correct them openly. And that took a lot of guts at the time. But I'm so glad I did that, because I don't think I would have been able to continue on and on and on if I was judging my work or comparing it. I spent so much of the first half of my life worrying about things and caring too much of what other people thought of me. But I'm determined that this part of my life will be golden. When you were 20 or 30, you thought you knew it all. When you're 50, you think, I know nothing whatsoever. And isn't that a wonderful thing, because you show up every day ready to learn?
Hello, I'm Vic Hope, and this is Bookshelfie, the podcast from the Women's Prize that asks women with lives as inspiring as any fiction to share the five books by women that have shaped them. Now, before we begin, remember to subscribe or follow so you never miss an episode, with thanks to our sponsor, Baileys. Today, I'm joined by Donna Ashworth. Donna is a number one Sunday Times bestselling author and the UK's number one bestselling poet. She started her social media accounts in 2018 in a bid to create a safe space for women to come together and connect. But her love of all things wordy quickly became the focus, and a past love for poetry was reignited. Over 10 books and nearly 2 million followers later, Donna's made it her daily mission to shower the world with words and bring poetry back into focus. Donna's best-selling books include To the Women, Wild Hope, Words to Live By, A Journal, Growing Brave, I Wish I Knew, Love, Loss, Life, and an illustrated book of children's poetry called Words Can Fly. Donna, welcome. It's so lovely to see you.
It's such a joy to be here.
Well, at the time of recording, last night was the British Book Awards.
It was indeed.
I did see you. And you wrote a really beautiful post actually today about not winning.
Yeah.
Tell us why that is such a great thing.
I think this whole journey of mine, because I'm an overthinker, I knew that if I didn't sort of make some changes in my thought process from the beginning, that I might ruin it for myself. Not enjoying the moment, taking the opportunities, and spending too much time thinking about what's next or what could go wrong. So I had decided before I even got to the awards last night that I was delighted not to win, to be shortlisted, to be invited, to be in that room, to be amongst it all, because it really signifies how far I've come as a person now that I'm in my 50s. If you'd have asked me 10 years ago about doing any of this, I would not have been able to even imagine it. I was so shut down, you know, lacking confidence and so on. So the joy for me was my humanity having evolved to the point where I could be a part of it at all. And I think because it's mental health, celebrate not winning as well as winning.
Well, you've won in so many ways. Do you know what I mean? You're rich in so many ways. When you look at how you rose to prominence with your poetry, which was really during the COVID lockdown, and amassing all of these followers and fans, how did it feel to experience this sort of surprise, widespread attention?
It still blows my mind on a daily basis, because to me it has been quite gradual. When you're in it, you know, you don't see the sort of the big change. But if I do stop to look back over it, or if somebody asks me about it, I am really blown away by how this whole thing unfolded, because it did unfold. And I just remember at every step allowing myself, again, not to overthink, which is so difficult for me, not to project into the future, but to just be in the moment that I'm in and enjoy every aspect of it and allow myself to be imperfect and not edit myself or change myself, because that was the whole point of this journey, was to write these mental health messages, I call them, to encourage women, you know, all women, but women my age as well, to just be really real with one another.
Yeah, I think that the community that you've built online is so special, and I love poetry online. There is a sort of a critique that sometimes comes called Insta poetry.
Yeah.
But I don't see that as negative in the slightest.
I don't either.
Because what a beautiful thing, what a brilliant thing to be able to open your Instagram, your social media, and get little drops of goodness, of seeing the world in this sparkling light, and being able to interrogate or articulate emotions that we might be having in the most succinct, gorgeous ways. What do you think are the positives of us having this new way of consuming poetry?
I mean, exactly what you just said so beautifully, by the way. Poetry was lost for a while.
Yeah.
The medium and the way that we read and went about our lives, it just didn't stop for poetry. So it was only for a fair few or people who actively sought it out. But social media brought it back to us all. And because our brains have evolved, because we're now on social media so much that they say that your attention span now has decreased so much that we need to be hooked within the first 2 or 3 seconds. Poetry has had to evolve to be a part of it. And so it has to be really accessible really quickly to hook people in. But it doesn't matter how people are hooked in. Once they're into a poem, they're not in their thinking anymore. They're in their feeling. That's what happens. You switch from a different part of your brain. You know that you're looking at a poem because of the way it appears on the page or on social media. So your brain instantly recognises that you're about to go through about 12 layers of social niceties and shallow small talk, and you're going deep. And so you prepare for that without even realising you've done it. And the impact, therefore, is great. So I just think there's no downside to me. Insta poetry is a wonderful thing because it's all good work. We need it. We need to help one another through. And these little messages do just that.
They do. We get to our deep layers so quickly.
Straight through that. The small talk.
Yeah.
You know, and you can only do that with a couple of things. Music and poetry are two of the biggest.
It cuts through. I'm so grateful to have it.
Mm.
Do you get a chance to read? Because we were talking just before we started recording about, you know, bringing all these books today. But when do you get to read if you're writing so much?
I don't get to read, so I have to do it with intention.
Okay.
And I have made it my thing this year that I'm going to read more. And I've loved it, but I've made it part of my sort of to-do list. I think sometimes you've got to put the things that you enjoy on your to-do list.
Yeah,
or you can forget, you know, that it's important.
Sometimes I have to put shower on there. Do the dishwasher, like otherwise.
Yeah. So I've been doing it with intention, and I'm very lucky. I get sent a lot of proofs. Mm. And there's something so delightful about getting an early copy of somebody's book that you love. And because as you're reading it, you feel like kind of one of the chosen few as well. And there's a real joy, secretive joy to that, because nobody else has read it, or few people. So this year I've read lots and lots. In the past week, I think I've read 3 or 4 books, which I'm so pleased
about. Your to-do list is getting done.
Well, I haven't done any of my other to-do list. That's the problem.
That's okay. Can wait. Well, on the subject of the books that you love, let's delve into your bookshelf you picked, the first of which is The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. Sylvia Plath's semi-autobiographical novel, The Bell Jar, follows the life of Esther Greenwood, a talented young woman who spirals into mental illness amidst the pressures of societal expectations and personal ambitions. Set in the 1950s, Esther's summer internship at a New York City magazine offers glimpses into the glamorous yet suffocating world of high society. As she grapples with the disintegration of her identity in the face of alienation and self-doubt, Esther's descent into depression becomes palpable. In beautiful and haunting prose, Plath delves into the complex experience of early adulthood and the pressures placed on intelligent young women in the mid-20th century America. part literary novel, part social critique, and part mental health narrative. Yeah. This coming-of-age story is considered a cornerstone of feminist literature. When did you first read this, and why have you chosen it today?
So, first of all, it was a very difficult choice to choose these books. It's the hardest question. It really put me...
I'm so sorry.
It really got me thinking. But we studied this in English. And I think I owe a huge amount to my English teacher, Mrs. Dunlop, because she opened our eyes to so many things that we might not have had growing up in a very normal school in a very small town in the middle of Scotland in the countryside. You know, it was a real sort of bubble of an upbringing. I remember when I first met Sylvia Plath, it was the first time I recognised somebody else's mental health journey that made me think about my own. Okay. And I recognised so much in how she felt and thought that I had not been able to put into words until that point. And I didn't really know anybody else who might have felt that way or spoken about it. So there was a real sort of when you feel seen in something or you feel recognition. And it wasn't a good recognition. You know, it was a chill down my spine recognition because I thought this is problematic to have this tricky, you know, mental health, to have this mindset that takes quite a lot of work. But nonetheless, you have to know that to be aware of what you're dealing with. So I think this is one of the first times that I became aware that I might be on quite a rocky road. Mm.
But that you're not alone on it.
Not alone.
Because someone else has experienced it, and there it is on the page.
Power of books. And before the internet, you know, back when I was a kid, we did the internet. If you'd have told us about the internet, we would have thought it was, you know, hocus pocus, pie in the sky magic. Books were everything, you know, and you didn't know about authors or writers until somebody put it in front of you. So I'm very grateful to my English teacher. And of course, Sylvia Plath's poetry was, you know, another big sort of gong of recognition for me, because I loved the way you could play around with words in poetic fashion all the way through my childhood. But I did feel that hers were often left me feeling quite bereft and cold, maybe uncared for. So my mission when I started to do it was to make sure that we can go there into the dark, but we must come out by the end of the poem, or we must leave a trail of breadcrumbs of hope to the light. So none of my poems will ever finish without that sort of, you know, the hand down to pull you out. Because I think that as humans, that's what we do with our friends. We do it with our family when they need our help. We go and we sit with them. And what we're really doing is trying to pull them out of wherever they are. So, yeah, I think this is where it probably all began for me.
So you realise that that was your intention when you write?
I realise it now, looking back.
Yeah.
I had a problem with Sylvia Plath's poetry for a long time, because I found it quite dark. And I was angered about that for some reason, because, you know, I want you to give me the survival steps here out. I don't just want you to say to me, isn't this an awful place that we're in?
But perhaps she didn't have the survival steps.
Exactly. It's not her fault.
Yeah, that's how it was.
And but it's interesting to look back on that now. And I wouldn't have done that if you hadn't have asked me about books that changed me. So I found this whole process really fascinating.
It's funny, people do come on the podcast and they look at the list, they compile the list and they look back on it and they go, oh, this says a lot about me that I hadn't even realised.
So interesting.
Yeah. Well, looking at some of the societal pressures that women faced at the time that Plath puts on the page in The Bell Jar, and the voice that she sort of gives to feelings that perhaps women were supposed to suppress around that time, or expected to. Do you sort of feel that connection between your work and Plath's exploration of the emotional undertow and the expectations around femininity, success, freedom?
Yeah, I think she was able to put so much into words that just hadn't really been put into words yet. And I think so much of it, you know, I would have been in a position in my life before I went out into the big bad world. So a lot of that was preemptive or, you know, exploratory for me. But I remember looking back onto it when it did become my life, my daily life, when I did leave home and go into the city and become part of society and find myself up against all of these things. Mm. I had some sort of ammunition.
She sort of prepared you.
Yeah, there was a, which, you know, I would have had to sort of, I don't even know how you would do that. You would just do it through the people that you meet and you would find your way. We always do. But yeah, she was able to put quite a lot of that into motion for me before I even needed it, which was great.
Well, this is 1950s yes, America. And yet you felt like it resonated, yeah, that you felt prepared for the society you were about to enter. Do you think that women today are still wrestling with many of the same pressures, albeit in different forms or maybe in the same forms, actually?
I think they've moved on. The pressures have evolved. They look slightly different. Mm. And there's so much that we have now that wouldn't have been there then. But the enormity of the weight of it, you know, the load that is on women, the pressure load, is still the same. Our shoulders are still, you know, really weighed down with these expectations that society puts on us to be the perfect everything, the perfect mother, friend, wife, sister, you know, colleague, and to do it all with aplomb and grace and don't get too emotional. And, you know, we just want you to look like the swan. We don't want to see the feet paddling. And so it doesn't do us any harm to be reminded how far we've come, but how much there still is that we can change. Women can change. We don't need anybody to give it to us now. We kind of need to give it to one another and say, you don't have to take all that on. You don't have to have all that weight on your shoulders. You can say no, you can put it down. So yeah, still an interesting topic.
Well, on the many facets of womanhood that you've just described there, let's move on to your second book, Shelfie Book, which is In Love and Trouble, Stories of Black Women by Alice Walker. From the Pulitzer Prize winning author of The Colour Purple, these stories, first published in 1984, show the immense range of Alice Walker's talent, from humour to stories of love, race and politics, reaffirming her position as one of the most important writers of the past 50 years, certainly one of my favourites. Alice Walker writes with such compassion about women carrying pain and love and about their survival and their resilience. What drew you to this collection?
Again, I have to owe this one to my English teacher, same English teacher, Mrs. Dunlop, because once more, this harks back to me growing up in a small town, in a very normal school, and not having access to culture or, you know, we didn't travel much. We were lucky enough to travel, our family, but we went to Spain and we went to France and, you know, so I didn't know much about the world and other cultures. We just didn't have access to it where we grew up. And this book shocked me, opened my eyes and took me down a pathway of, you know, looking into other ways, other people's lives and other, you know, things that were going on around the world other than my own little life and my friends and what we were struggling with. So that was my first gateway into, wow, it affected me again, not in a hugely positive way at the time. I found it quite hard work. I found it quite upsetting. I found it quite depressing. Mm-hmm. To know that that kind of inequality and pain existed and that people were treated like that and, you know, hurt my heart. But when you get past that point, your eyes are wide open. You're far more empathetic, you know, you're able to go out into the world and be of better service because of what somebody else has been clever enough to put down in a book, that you can then absorb all of that completely. But I thought it's a book of short stories. And I actually only really remember two or three of them, but I haven't forgot them ever. And they often pop into my mind. They had such a huge impact on me. Just a wonderful writer and a fascinating book.
Yeah. Alice Walker is like the master of showing you what it feels like to be in someone else's shoes.
And absolutely.
The empathy that yes. cultivates.
Yeah.
Many of the stories explore intergenerational pain and trauma, particularly for Black women and mothers. Do you feel that becoming a mother and a grandmother has shaped the way you now look at the world and probably the way that you write as well?
Oh, 100%. You are never the same after you have a child. In fact, it was so shocking for me to come home with that baby in my arms and every single thing in the world looked different. It was all very dangerous. Everything had the ability to harm my baby, and I suddenly became hyper aware, hyper paranoid, you know, again, not in a good way at first. I found it quite overwhelming. But these are the basic hormonal survival, you know, instincts that women are given when they give birth so that they do keep that baby alive. And I think once you stop to think about that and think, okay, this is normal, I'm meant to feel like this, this is how the human race has survived, maybe I can tone it down a touch, because I did become unable to watch the news. I found everything so scary and upsetting. And I did, you know, there was a point at which my husband said to me, you have to do something about this now, because I didn't want to see headlines on a newspaper if children were involved. So it changes absolutely everything. And of course, you're then into new book territory when you're reading to your kids, when they get to that age, you know, where they're able to be a part of you reading to them. It's such a wonderful thing. My sister and I were just talking about all the amazing books that we loved as kids, and it's a joy.
It really is. And oh my gosh, our antenatal class, they had us crawling around so that we'd be on the level that the babies would be on to see what's a hazard. And it turns out our entire house.
Everything is a hazard.
Yeah.
And suddenly you think, oh, this world is far too dangerous for my child. What on earth am I going to do?
It's so true about the words that you consume, the images that you see. And one of my very good friends says that she now struggles with any novel about horrible things happening to children. And I said to her, oh, what did you think of Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver, which, of course, has won the Women's Prize, which we love so much, and which I very luckily read before having a child. She was like, I couldn't. And I know it's amazing, but I just I couldn't.
No,
it was too painful.
I completely understand that. And you do have to have a clean diet, because you do have to be careful, because when I look back now, I think that I had postnatal depression with my second child, but I didn't know it at the time. You know, the power of hindsight. And when that happens, you do have to be careful. You do have to clean up your diet of what you absorb and consume until you're back in your bones again. And you know who you are, and you're not in that vulnerable place that, again, hormones put us in for a reason. It is part of the whole evolutionary cycle, but it can be hard. So I did have to go through a couple of years of just saying, no, I can't do this. It has to be all sweetness and light for a while. And then I was fine again, and now I can do it.
Well, that's because we can do many things, just not necessarily all at the same time.
Exactly.
That's okay. And Alice Walker's characters, they really navigate both their strength and their vulnerability at the same time sometimes. Why do you think that society still struggles to allow women to fully embody both of these things?
It's an absolutely brilliant question, because it does seem still to be seen as such a threat. Women can't be powerful and strong and emotional at the same time. We can't be open and respected. You know, we can't be vulnerable and respected. And yet I think there's nothing more powerful. There's nothing stronger than being able to show yourself in your vulnerability, or to be able to tell the truth and be open. So I'm in huge admiration for women who can do it, who can share the ugly as well as the gorgeous and the joyful about their stories, about their lives, because it's in the ugly where the love lives. That's where other people find their little treasure map out of whatever they're in at the moment. That's how we share. That's how we help one another, you know, to find their own way. So, but I don't know why it's still so frowned upon. I think it's changing. Do you think it's changing?
I think so. And I think, you know, your, you know, testament to that fact, it's the openness and it's the vulnerability of your work, which has brought together and fostered such a sense of community. And I do want to know what you make of having this real sense of community surrounding your work online. does it validate or does it add a sort of extra layer of pressure now that there are so many people invested in it?
There's no pressure. And no. The reason there's no pressure is twofold, I think. And it's because in the beginning, I decided that I wouldn't put pressure on myself. Otherwise, I would ruin it for myself.
It's like the awards.
It's like everything. You know, if you overthink it, if you're trying to be perfect, it's already ruined. So, I decided that I would write these mental health messages, these poems, however they came out. I wouldn't edit them. I wouldn't think about what kind of a poem it was or, judge it or critique it. I wouldn't compare it. It would go out and I literally would press send on social media immediately so that I couldn't mess with it, so that I couldn't change my mind, and so that that poem became its own little entity and had its own journey separate from me. And that poem went out into the world and found its tribe. And, that took the pressure off me immediately. I allowed myself to be imperfect. I allowed myself to make mistakes and correct them openly. And that took a lot of guts at the time. But I'm so glad I did that, because I don't think I would have been able to continue on and on and on if I was judging my work or comparing it. It's like putting your foot on a hosepipe of creativity. The minute you start to say, is this good? You're done. You're out of your creative heart and you're into your thinking brain. And the two don't often, work well together when it comes to art and things like that. So I did that from the start, which is the reason. And because I did that, my community were the same. They all were delighted to be imperfect and show up flaws and all and share the ugly and share. And we found such liberation in it that we then bolster one another. So it perpetuates on and on and on. So it's one of the best things I ever did was to decide that the work I did would be openly imperfect. Because then when criticism does come, you're not as affected by it as you would have been if you'd have been striving to be perceived as perfect.
It's amazing to think it's the imperfection that fosters that sense of connection and community.
Completely. And what I didn't know at the time is that AI was about to explode. Mm. And I can spot an AI caption a mile away. I don't know if you can.
I can now.
Yes.
Yeah. At first.
At first, but no.
They're
very obvious to me now. So your imperfection, your uniqueness becomes a precious commodity now, because AI can't do imperfection. Mm-hmm. It can't. It's not in its, it just can't do it. So I often throw a little mistake in here, there and everywhere just to remind everybody
that you're human.
Absolutely. And that mistakes are wonderful. They're all part of the tapestry and they add something in.
Well, on the subject of imperfections and mistakes being wonderful, let's talk about Bridget Jones' Diary. Your third book, Shelfie Book, is Bridget Jones' Diary by Helen Fielding. Her first novel sparked a phenomenon when it was published in 1996 that led to four books, newspaper columns, and the smash hit film series. As Bridget documents her struggles through the social minefield of her 30s and tries to weigh up the eternal question, Daniel Cleaver or Mark Darcy, she turns for support to four indispensable friends, Shazza, Jude, Tom, and a bottle of Chardonnay. This culturally iconic book documented 90s womanhood at a specific cultural moment and helped redefine commercial women's fiction for a new generation of readers. It's quite a contrast, this choice, to your first two, which are quite literary picks. Tell me why it's been important in your life and why you wanted to include Bridget Jones in your list today.
It's so funny because after, in my late teens, I became quite mentally unwell and I crashed and burned and, I was suffering with anorexia. And so it was a whole, it was my first experience of, touching rock bottom and coming back out of it. And so I came back out of it very intentionally using affirmations, reading self-help books and looking for the light. So you can literally see me looking for the light with the Bridget Jones pick, because that summed up that chapter of my life. I was, I'd moved into the city of Manchester. I lived there with my best friend. We were, we were working, we were part of society, we were having a great time. But Bridget Jones just reminded us all, again, imperfection is a wonderful thing. You know, it celebrated the ridiculousness of womanity as well. And, you know, the diary with the weighing yourself and the how many cigarettes you've smoked and so on and so forth. And all the silly thoughts that we have, even though we're also having deep thoughts, we're also having, you know, issues, but how they coexist with that little train of thought. So I was directly Helen's audience, you know, when she wrote Bridget Jones, and it became a community. We were suddenly in a community, single women who were just trying to carve out a life, suddenly had a community, and we were Bridget's gang, and it made us feel joyful about things that might have been a little bit shameful before. And it was just a wonderful way of seeking the light and staying in the light and reminding ourselves that we're here to have a laugh. Friends will pull you through, and nothing is ever that bad, you know, that singing to Chaka Khan and Celine Dion won't fix.
We look back. I mean, I say look back. It was only, what, last year there was a new film.
Yeah.
And it feels still very much part of the fabric of our everyday. Bridget Jones is an icon. But we look back at the 90s and that obsession with weight, it was damaging. Clearly.
It's really bad.
And we had a very warped perception of what we should look like,
yeah,
how we should be as women. She's constantly measuring herself against impossible standards.
Yeah.
Do you think that women have become kinder to themselves since the book was published, or has social media intensified that pressure?
We have definitely become kinder.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it for a fact because I was so sensitive to it all at the time. And I struggled so deeply with it all at the time. So I've had the pleasure of seeing that begin to come around to the light. Women are kinder. We were so competitive back then because we had to be, because there was only ever one seat in any corporate table for one woman. And it was like playing musical chairs. You had to bump somebody else out with an elbow to sit in it. And now we know that if there are not enough seats, we can bring seats, we can make seats, you know, we can buy the table, we can build the table from IKEA, we can do flat pack. You know, we've opened that up so much. And we also know now that we don't have to compete. We can help one another. There's room for everyone. So we now pull each other. I see it all the time. And I'm delighted every time that I see it. And when I hear the younger generation being kind to each other and saying nice things, and even more importantly, being kind to themselves. Mm-hmm. I was at a birthday party for a 12-year-old, and these two girls were taking a selfie and they looked at it, and one of them said, "You look great in this photo." And the other girl said, "Oh yeah, I'm really photogenic."
I would never have spoken to myself like that.
And I thought my heart was going to explode out of my chest. And the other girl went, "Yeah, you are." And it was, that was it. That interaction was so small, and yet to me, it was, you know, it was everything. That's how far we've come, and there's a long way to go. Social media has ramped up the visibility of it all, but the baseline is kind, I think.
I've always said, you know, talk to yourself the way you would talk to your friend. I think Bridget Jones' diary perfectly exemplifies that, because her friends will always big her up, raise her up, even when she talk badly, yeah, to herself. And I always say, if my friend says something about themselves, like, "Oh, I'm not
you
looking great today," I say, "Don't talk to my friend like that."
Yeah, you would not have it. You just
no.
wouldn't tolerate it. But the way we speak to ourselves is always the worst.
Yeah.
But again, that's so changing as well.
Well, if you could sit down with your younger self at the point of reading Bridget Jones' diary, at the point of looking for the light in your self-help books when you needed that before,
yeah,
the poetry, what advice do you think she needed to hear then?
I think two words, lighten up. You know, I've always taken everything so seriously, and I've felt everything so deeply, far too deeply. And I've overthought in such dramatic ways, you know, my whole life, that the two words, lighten up, it doesn't mean pull your socks up and get on with it, because I hate those kind of, you know, sometimes you need to get on with it. But I also don't like it when people dismiss feelings and say, just stiff upper lip, keep your, you know, that's not great. But lighten up reminds me that life is ridiculous. Yes, it's really hard, but laughter is available whenever you need it, and it really does help. we humans are ridiculous, and really we're not here to suffer. We're here to find as much beauty and joy, even amidst deep pain, as we possibly can. We're here to help one another. We're here to constantly reach out to one another. Nobody's ever separate. No matter how lonely you feel, you're never alone. We're literally connected to everything that surrounds us. And those two words, lighten up, remind me not to just, you know, dismiss myself, but to turn everything around and seek the light, let it in. And it can be as simple as watching a funny video on Instagram. That's how quickly intentionally seeking the light can get you out of any kind of thought loop or toxic, you know, pattern that you might be invested in that moment, and get you back out into a place of, come on, let's look for the joy here. We'll get through this. This is not going to last forever. Lighten up.
I feel like poetry is the perfect place to seek the light.
Yes,
to seek that joy.
It is. And you've got to go into the dark. Mm. You know, that's the whole point of it. If we were skirting around it, it wouldn't be any good to anyone. We have to acknowledge that people are going through terrible things. Life is painful. It's really difficult. Even when it's good, it's complicated and difficult. And acknowledging that and seeing one another amidst it all is the quickest way to get out of it and back into the light. The more you avoid it, the bigger the circle gets, I think, and you're just going to fall into it, you know, much more deeply.
This episode of Bookshelfie is sponsored by Baileys. Baileys is proudly supporting the 2026 Women's Prize for Fiction, helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out baileys.com for our favourite Baileys recipes. Donna, let's talk about your fourth Bookshelfie book now, which is Menopausing, The Positive Roadmap to Your Second Spring by Davina McCall and Dr. Naomi Potter. For too long, women have had to keep quiet about the menopause, its onset, its symptoms, its treatments, and what it means for us. Menopausing breaks this silence once and for all by exploring and explaining the science, debunking damaging myths, and smashing the taboos around the perimenopause and menopause. This book aims to equip women to make the most informed decisions about their health and their lives. Winner of Book of the Year at the 2023 British Book Awards, this game-changing title helped shift how menopause is talked about in the UK. I mean, women go through such enormous physical and emotional transitions, whether it's motherhood, whether it's menopause,
yeah,
that society just often underestimates, yeah, or doesn't talk about. Is there a particular transitional stage that you felt affected you the most strongly?
I think all of them, because I am the type of person that you know, hits every branch on the tree quite.
It's a really beautiful way of putting it, though.
If there is a wall to crash against, I'm going to crash against it hard. Because I feel everything so deeply, and I know I'm not alone. There are many people like me. I'm neurodiverse, so that, you know, I have sensory overwhelm, and I'm able to really focus in on frequencies and things like that, that can be a lot if you're unaware and you don't know how to handle it. So I've had to learn my whole life to better manage the way that my mind is, the way my brain is wired. And you can see that this is another community. So Bridget was a community for me and my friends at the time. We found a place, we found a reason, we found this is us, you know, this is a thing. And menopausing is exactly the same. What Davina and Dr. Naomi have done for women of a certain age, and actually we don't use that phrase anymore. Sarah Cox decided we don't use that phrase anymore. We just say women.
Yeah, we just say women.
But, you know, I'm in midlife now and I'm in menopause. So for me, that was just another community. And again, it's about sharing the roadmap through. And that didn't happen before. So women struggled really unnecessarily when they could have just had some information shared from the generations above that would have hugely helped. But they didn't know because it wasn't discussed. And, you know, it was hush, hush. Don't talk about this. Just come out on the other side when you're ready to come back into society. And we do that for so many things. We do it for grieving. We do it for menopause. And I'm delighted to say that's all changed. Now we can do it openly, out loud, and help one another through it and celebrate it at the same time. And that's what that book did for all of us.
Oh, so many women. I remember in 2023 when it won, and it was such a big moment.
Huge
I was there.
Moment.
Davina was backstage doing what Davina does, which is to hold your arm and
we
make you
Davina.
Feel like the only person in the world looking you straight in the eyes. She's amazing.
Queen Davina.
And you've met her.
Yes. I'm lucky enough to have met her several times now on this journey. She's supported me like, you know, family.
Yeah.
I can't even begin to tell you, for no reason other than she is just Queen Davina of
yeah.
women, who does that for so many women. How she has the time and energy to help so many of us, I'll never know, but she does. She's diligent about it, intentional about it, and casts a hugely wide net. And I'm lucky enough to have had her light shine my way. She's incredible. And what she has done for our community at this time in life is mind-blowing, because I can't even begin to imagine how we were coping before.
Before, when we didn't really have the information, and moreover, we weren't prepared to have the conversations.
How, permission.
Permission.
To be menopausal
yeah.
and loud about it and open about it and not be judged or judge one another is that's a massive change. It's a massive shift.
What does a book like Menopausing do for that sense of isolation when you don't have that information
yeah.
or anyone to
yeah.
talk to about it?
It's gone.
Mm.
Something that could have been another depression for me had I not had the information or knew what to expect or could see amazing women around me leading the way. That could have been another bump in my, you know, rocky path. But it wasn't. And I totally believe that's because of the conversations opened by Davina and other women who are doing it as well. I think I got to avoid that branch on the tree, because I've kind of sailed through it, not sailed through it in a way that I haven't had the symptoms or the downsides. But when you have the information, when you have awareness and, more importantly, permission to not be ashamed of it, that changes the way you experience anything. So I've experienced it with a real dollop of joy.
Yeah, that's what a mindset to have, what an approach to have, and what a place to be in. When women's health issues have historically been neglected, not only by the medical establishment,
yeah.
and we know this for sure,
yes.
but also by wider society, you then have individuals who are sort of taking it upon themselves. Davina's spoken so openly about wanting women to feel informed rather than ashamed about having these conversations. Do you feel a sense of gratitude to these women who've done that?
Hugely, and I don't stop saying it.
Yeah.
And I'm really sort of vocal about it because it's so important, and I'm really grateful. And so many of us are grateful. And I hope that, you know, it's inspired a million women to go on and do something similar, share something, and, you know, find something that they can help other women with. And I really think it sparked, you know, a further revolution amongst women to remind us that we have needed to gather since the very dawn of time. Women have to gather, because it's when we gather. I mean, you put women in a room, four or five women, and you leave them an hour. They're coming out. They've bought something that somebody in that room said, you have to get this, put it in your Amazon basket, here we go. They've handed something to somebody that, don't worry, I've got one at home, you have this, it's going to help. They've shared a recipe or a therapy or a way of healing. They have passed on so many things in that hour. You don't come away from a lunch with women or friends where you haven't been inspired to read something or do something or take a class. It's just what we do. And I think culturally, we might have lost that for a while. We still used to do it, you know, maybe 100 years ago with Women's Institute and things like that. But we weren't doing enough of it. When I was younger, or when I was in my 20s and 30s, I see it coming back around now with yoga and, you know, healing groups and book clubs and, oh, so many ways that women are gathering just to what they're really doing is saying, when we get together and sit in a circle in a room, our power is reignited. And we can't even really prove why that happens, but we know that it happens.
I always say that this is my favorite thing to do, these episodes of this podcast. And it's because I always come away from it having gained something, whether it's a book recommendation yes. or a piece of wisdom. And you've just hit the nail on the head. It's because I'm sitting with a woman and we chat for an hour and we exchange,
yeah.
we share. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. And sharing and community is such a strong theme across your poetry, as yeah. is embracing every stage of life. It's in your poetry and it's in your choices that you brought today. Has getting older changed your relationship with yourself creatively, and therefore your writing, and also emotionally?
Absolutely. I mean, I think getting older, despite the difficulties of it as well, is such a gift. And it does sound cliche, but it really is such a huge gift, because you do wake up and you kind of go, oh, I'm in the next half now, if I'm lucky. And actually, statistically, every single day becomes more precious the older you get, because you know people who are not here. And I know so many people who are not, you know, at level 51, as I call it, who would love to have been at level 51. So you do, you feel the gratitude now of just the simple fact that you are still here, still trying, still making mistakes, still showing up imperfectly, still feeling like a 12-year-old wrapped inside a wrinklier, you know, body, but with this new wisdom that sometimes you think, oh, wow, you know, I'm fully functioning wise crone. When did that happen? But still mixed with the, you know, the young version of you. So it's a really eye-opening, enlightening time getting older. And it really does change how you write, because you're seeing the world from a different place. You know, you're at a different place in your orbit. The view is different. And you've got a much bigger level of hindsight, and you've got so many life lessons learned. And you've got the wisdom to understand that you don't really know anything, even though you feel like you know a lot. When you were 20 or 30, you thought you knew it all. When you're 50, you think, ah, I know nothing whatsoever. And isn't that a wonderful thing? Because you show up every day ready to learn. And I'm more willing to learn or be corrected now than I ever was. And that's a wonderful feeling. Every day's a school day.
I love this idea that the older we get, the more precious every day
it really
becomes.
Is.
And that is the perfect place to talk about your fifth and final book, which is Enough by
yes.
Dawn French. This is the fifth and a brand new novel from comedian Dawn French, centred on seemingly healthy 68-year-old Etta, who gathers her family together to explain it'll be the last day of her life. The book unfolds over the following 24 hours as her family tries to understand her decision, confront long-buried emotions, and reckon with questions about aging, autonomy, love, and letting go. So this is Dawn French's brand new novel. What was it about it that made you include it in your list?
Oh, this is a brave gift of a book that Dawn has given us. I adore Dawn. I adore her writing. She has such a wonderful way of painting the messiness of humanity in the most delicious way.
She does.
So, you know, the messier we are, the more flawed and failing that we are, somehow she makes that more attractive than had it been the opposite. And so I adore her writing for that reason. But this particular book is a sucker punch of a roller coaster ride. And I have always been not fixated, but determined to raise the topic of suicide when I can. And I know that sounds like a really strange thing to say, but once again, it all comes back to we need to talk more about things that are hard. Because the more we talk about it, the lighter they become, the more awareness there is, the less shame there is, the less darkness. It's not as dangerous a place if everybody has some sort of level of conversation about it and awareness. And I try and do that with my poetry, and I try and do that, you know, with my events and so on. So when a writer does it so beautifully and so boldly, I'm all in. And I was lucky enough to get an early copy of the book, and I devoured it in 2 days straight. It is a journey. It is a journey. It brings up so many thoughts, so many questions, so many you know, points of view from the children, the grandchildren, you know, friends and so on. And it really keeps you thinking and guessing the whole way through it because you don't know what to think. You don't know what's going to happen until the very, very end. And then it just, you know, it leaves you with that. I don't think thinking about death is morbid. I don't think there's anything more life-affirming than remembering that you're going to die. Because the minute you have that thought, or you think about someone who isn't here anymore, you're back in the moment of living. Mm. You're grateful for the moment of living. Your eyes are open, you're looking around and you're seeing this life as a gift that it is. And you're seeing it in vibrant 3D shapes and colours. So when I shut the cover of that book, I did that thing where I had to go, oh, breathe. I didn't think I breathed for the last 2 hours because, you know, I was so invested. And all I could think about when I shut the book was life is just wonderful, you know. And even having gone through that journey that the book is, that's what I was left with. Joy and love and light and determination to go on more brightly.
Each time you talk about one of your picks, one of your bookshelfy picks, we keep coming back to being present.
Yes.
And in doing so, I keep coming back to being present right now here in this room. Yeah.
We forget.
Yeah, you've got to remember. We have to remind ourselves.
Yeah, every single day we forget. It's the easiest thing in the world to be sitting thinking about what happened an hour ago or what's going to happen in 2 hours' time or what might happen next week because we want to be prepared, you know, we want to be organised. But actually being in the moment, once you get the hang of it, the knack of it, it's such a wonderful thing and it really changes absolutely everything and it takes a huge amount of stress away. Yeah. And if you are an overthinker or if you're an anxious person, being in the moment is the most wonderful way. Mindfulness.
Well, alongside that mindfulness and being present, enough reflects a growing conversation around self-acceptance.
Yes.
Which I do think are inexorably intertwined, but it's self-acceptance later in life in this book. Do you feel like women become freer as they age or do you feel like there's more expectation upon them?
I've become freer. Mm. But then I'm a big believer in finding yourself a midlife muse. Find these women and follow what they're doing. So I follow Davina, you know, I follow Adon. I follow amazing women who are aging in a way that I think that looks great. I don't want to work harder. I don't want to feel worse about myself. I want to live more, work less, enjoy work more. And I want to feel better about myself. And I want to feel more available for, you know, the true things in life. I spent so much of the first half of my life worrying about things and caring too much of what other people thought of me, that I'm determined that this part of my life will be golden, you know, that I will ditch all of those things piece by piece because it is a shedding of many layers of skin. And if you don't know how to do it, find somebody who's doing it and watch what they do and follow them and do it intentionally. So I just think getting older is wonderful. I'm more free now than I've ever been.
Yeah. That shedding. And those women that you mentioned, Davina and of course Dawn French, they talk and write so candidly about body image, about self-worth, about aging.
Yeah.
Was there something in this book that particularly resonated with your own experience as a woman?
I mean, yes. You know, the main character of Etta was a complicated character. And so it took a while for the reader to get into who she actually was. And that was very deliberately and beautifully done by Dawn. So you're trying to work out why she's in this place, why she's decided it's her last day. And you don't actually find that out until way into the book. But as with most women, you know, she was thinking about other people first and she was trying to find a way to make everything easier for everybody else and wasn't putting herself in any position of importance, which is, you know, hugely relatable for all women, I think. We all do that. And we all need that reminder that this is about you too. This is your party. You're also invited. You don't have to just make it wonderful for everyone else.
Both you and Dawn, you mix humour with vulnerability, which you've expressed is really important. It's a great way to deal even with the hardest things. And this book does it. It deals with death, as does your collection Loss, which offers readers words to weather the many waves of grief, as a quote. Can you tell us a little bit more about this collection and the journey of grief that it charts?
I think it goes back to the conversation that I have a lot, which is why do we not talk more about grief as a society and a community and, you know, a race? Because it's the one thing that we're all going to experience. Bar none, we will all grieve. And yet it's one of the things we talk about less. And if you are somebody who struggles with anticipatory grief or, again, overthinking, worrying about the future, grief can be an issue before it even happens. You know, you can begin grieving things and worrying about things before it even that chapter comes into play. And before you know it, you're in a real pickle. It's, you know, it's not an easy way to live your life. So I was always one of those people that worried about everything and felt everybody else's grief and worried about the world. And even as a child, went to bed thinking about children in plight that I didn't even know and would never meet. And, you know, and I realised in my sort of teens, early 20s, that I could not go through life this way because it was going to be impossible if I was going to grieve for everyone. And not just, you know, grief that came into my life, then it was going to be a struggle. And for me, that meant writing about it, talking about it, sharing, you know, finding ways. I used to be a singer-songwriter in my early 20s, and I wrote poetry as a child and a teenager. And so to be able to do that intentionally, with purpose in my 40s, out of nowhere, was a gift from the heavens. I started to write grief poetry because I felt that we were using the same poems at funerals over and over from hundreds of years ago, and they're beautiful. But also life is moving on all the time, and, you know, we are moving on, and the way that we love is changing in the way that we live. And I wanted to sort of provide things for people to use in that moment. And I wanted to provide words because we're not taught how to grieve, and we're not taught how to talk to people who are grieving, and we're not taught how to feel about people who are grieving, how to make it better or easier, or we're just not taught any of it. I thought, why don't I put some words down that I think are right and may be useful to people in that situation? And it snowballed and spiraled from there. And to write grief poetry and to have people use it in their worst moments is one of the biggest honours that I'll ever know in this life. It has been a joy in a roundabout, bittersweet way, as grief is, you know, it's the side of a coin, love and grief. So it's just become something that I've really loved to do.
Yeah, I always like to think of grief as that knot in your throat or those tears building in your eyes that is all that love that doesn't have that place to go anymore, but it's love.
Exactly. And the minute you remind somebody who's grieving about the love, yeah, it does help.
It does.
Because the greater the love, the greater the grief, you know. And when somebody larger than life leaves, the grief that comes on the back of that is larger than life. It's overwhelming. And there is a kind of justice to that. Of course, my life's forever changed. Of course, the world looks different. This person is no longer here. But if I can pull the love back out whenever I can, if I can just feel the love some days instead of only the grief, then I'm winning at life, you know. I can remember them with joy and gladness, and then some days the grief is too much to bear, and you have to just swim in the waves of it, and the acceptance of that, no shame, no judgment, no timeline, no get on with it. You don't get on with it, you just learn to know that every single day is going to be different, and you're ready for it, and you've got your own back, and you'll pull the love out whenever you can and remember the person, you know, happily whenever you can.
I really love this reframing. And so I'd love to know, has the way that you write publicly changed the way that you talk to yourself privately or feel privately?
Absolutely. It's such a good question. It's hugely changed. I've worked a lot on my, you know, inner critic and my self-talk over the years. I've always used Louise Hay's affirmations and her meditations to, you know, to learn to love yourself, to learn to even just like yourself, or some days just to accept yourself is enough, as long as you're not berating yourself, being hard on yourself, judging yourself, shaming yourself, because it's so easy to fall into that trap of being the worst person in your own life. And I'm always saying you're only a kind person if you're kind to yourself too. If you're a kind person, you wouldn't leave anyone out. So if you're leaving yourself out, you're not a kind person. You're people pleasing. Mm. That's different. You must include yourself in that kindness. And because I'm writing about it all the time, I'm constantly refreshing my own self-talk and seeing when it slips, recognising when it's going back down the other way and pulling it back up and thinking, right, Donna, you need to work on that now. So perfect question. It really has helped.
And it's a little reminder for anyone listening or watching now as well. We can always pull ourselves back out.
Oh, we do. It's a daily adjustment.
It's an exercise.
Absolutely. Just like you would adjust the way that you eat or drink or work out or whatever you do. You know, you make little tweaks and adjustments, and some days you're owning it and some days you're not. And it's the same with all mental health sort of mindset issues and self-talk. It's a work every day.
Well, Donna, we have gone on a journey through your 5 books. It's been a beautiful and enlightening one, and I've kept reminding myself to be present and pulled myself out when I need to, because you've taken us to those places. So just journeying back through them very quickly, if you had to book one book as a favourite, which would it be and why?
From my 5.
Yeah. I know it was hard enough that we asked you to pick 5.
It's really hard.
And now I'm asking for 1.
And look, my mind's gone completely blank. I don't know if I can choose. I don't know if I can choose.
We've got Enough by Dawn French. We've got Menopausing. We've got Bridget Jones' Diary. We've got In Love and Trouble and The Bell Jar. They're all pretty different.
They are really different. So I think I would have to go with Menopausing for the very simple reason it's a reminder that I'm not alone. Mm. It's a reminder of the unseen community that I can feel, even if I can't see them. I know that they exist. They're out there and there are millions of them. And it's a reminder that whatever you need help with, you can find it. It's a reminder that, you know, reaching out, being open, being honest, saying it out loud is always the way forward. And it's a reminder that people are good, people are kind, they want to share, they want to help each other. They found a way and they want to share that with you so that you can have a better experience. So I think that encompasses all that's good about life and all that would help to keep me on track. So yeah, I would have to go with Menopausing.
Well, that thread of community and sharing yes. has run through all of your picks and everything we've chatted through today. So thank you for sharing with us.
I've loved it.
It's been such a pleasure.
A joy. Thank you for making me think so deeply about my best books.
And right back at you. I'm Vic Hope, and that was Bookshelfie from the Women's Prize, supported by Bailey's and produced by Birdline Media. Thanks for joining me for this episode. You'll find all the books that we discussed in our show notes. There's also a link to our bookshop.org shelf, where every purchase supports independent bookshops and the work of the Women's Prize Trust, a charity helping build a better future by championing women's writing. Now remember to hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode. And if you liked this one, then leave us a rating or review to help other readers discover even more brilliant books by women. See you next time.